Welcome back to this special edition of The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. We're bringing you the inaugural edition of the University of Delaware Journalism Program's Front Page Cafe, a new speaker series bringing journalists and other writers to UD to highlight their work and tell their stories. In our first half hour, we heard Catherine Miles, who earned her doctorate in English at UD back in 2001, discuss her latest book, Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. This half hour, we have the question and answer session with Miles from last month's event at the Deer Park Tavern in Newark.
So North Korea is doing underground nuclear tests. Let's say that North Korea blows up a nuclear bomb underground and it travels through whatever geological formations that are underground, and it causes a building in South Korea to collapse and it kills 5,000 South Koreans. Would you consider that an act of war?
Could you all hear the question? Okay, so loosely, and I should just change the question because this is a hard question to answer. McKay said, what's your favorite earthquake and why? No, that's not what McKay said. McKay said, if North Korea is detonating nuclear weapons, which they are, and if these nuclear weapons are creating significant seismic activity, which they are, if that significant seismic activity, say, collapses a building in a place like South Korea, should we consider that an act of war? I got the question. I don't have the answer is the problem. Okay, so let's break this down, right? Human-induced seismicity, which for me was one of the biggest surprises of this book. I had no idea how many ways that we create earthquakes. And I outline a few of those ways in the book. Things like the construction of dams, the construction of high-rise buildings, the digging of tunnels, the digging of mines, the mining for natural resources, the injection of chemical weapons munitions, these all create induced seismicity. That we know. So who is responsible in that case? I don't know if we know that. I mean, ethically speaking, it seems to me like the people who create the earthquakes are the ones who are responsible. If it's a national system, what do we do? I mean, I certainly think that holding someone responsible is fair in that case, if it can be proven, and I guess that would be the first case, right? What we know is that small earthquakes can create larger earthquakes. We know that it's not necessarily an instantaneous connection, right? So for instance, there can be a small earthquake in Napa, and 5 days later, 10 days later, there can be a big earthquake in San Diego, and maybe the Napa earthquake created the San Diego earthquake, and maybe it didn't. We don't know yet how to substantially prove that. So that would be the first thing, obviously, right? You know, can we prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? If we can, then yeah, I think they should be held accountable. Is it an act of war? I don't know about that. Is it an act of utter carelessness? Definitely. But deciding what we're going to do in this age of, you know, Anthropocene activity, anthropogenic induced activity. Some of you may have seen the report that our CO2 emissions spiked again for the first time in a couple of years, and they think it's because the amount of coal that's been burned in China over the past year. To what degree do we hold China accountable for that? That's a really good and hard question. You know, if we're setting off earthquakes in San Diego and they, you know, impact Mexico, to what degree are we responsible and accountable to Mexico? I think that's both a political and an ethical question. I'd like to believe we live in a world where people, you know, own the harm that they do and do good work as a result, but I know that that's a much more difficult political problem as well. So that was my dodge of your question.
You revealed to me at the bar, much to your, it was a big mistake, that you were a philosophy major as an undergraduate, is that right?
I was a philosophy major as an undergraduate.
So McKay's question is, let's stay with this question.
What?
Because
there was a hand up over there.
No, but it's an intended and known, right? It's an intended and known harm. So it looks like it's something like causing an avalanche above a cabin or something like that, where you know that if you shoot this round into the snowbank, it's going to cause it just looks like nature is a medium here, and
how is it intended?
On the assumption that you've done the calculations here, you know the snow's heavy, et cetera, et cetera. And I take it that McKay's example is something that was intentional, right? or was it not?
Well, this is a great example, right? North Korea is testing its nuclear weapons, right? Okay. It's not testing its nuclear weapons with the aim of knocking down buildings in South Korea.
Yeah, you're off the hook. That's right. Okay.
But
good. You're off the hook for now. What's the next question? Real briefly, could you explain what underlies the lack of preparedness? Why are people not prepared? Why don't they get more prepared?
I think that to some degree there's a disturbing amount of hubris in us as a species, that we honestly really believe that we are in charge and we can control things. And we honestly believe that nothing bad will befall us, right? And this is true in all kinds of ways, right? Like, how many of you have recently had a colonoscopy? Some. How many of you should have had a colonoscopy? But you don't have time, or you think it won't happen to you. Like, we tend to, like, you know, make our way through the world believing that if not invincible, that we're really kind of strong. So part of it is this general hubris. The other part of it is that we do tend to have a real blind eye for natural disasters. And I talked to a very smart guy named Paul Slovic, who runs the Risk Research Center at the University of Oregon. And he says, listen, if you ask the average American what is the biggest sort of threat they face on a daily basis, any guesses what they'll tell you? That might be true today. It wasn't true when he did his study, but that might actually be true, and probably for good reason. What else might an American say is the biggest risk they face?
Traffic.
They should say that because it's true, but they never do.
Terrorism
is number one, and nuclear disaster is number two. This is what most Americans believe is the biggest threat they face on any given daily basis. When the reality of the situation is traffic accidents, disease, and frankly, natural disasters are infinitely more likely. So the question that I don't have an answer to, but is something that we should philosophize about at length, is why? Why are we so worried about these things that are actually pretty far down the list of things that might happen? And why do we have such a blind eye for these things that should? One reason, when it comes to earthquakes, is because very few of us have experienced one, period. Right? How many people here have been in a moderate to severe earthquake? Okay, more people than I expected. That's great. Not great, but interesting. The last really significant earthquake that happened in the United States was in 1989, the Loma Prieta earthquake, the World Series earthquake, 1989. Unfortunately for me, I'd like to believe I'm a young and spry chicken, but unfortunately for me, a good number of Americans weren't even born in 1989. And a lot of people weren't even there, right? And so if we haven't seen it, if we haven't witnessed it, if we haven't experienced it, we tend to think it's not really a threat. Superstorm Sandy blows up the coast, right? It approaches New Jersey and New York. In time, New Jersey issues evacuation warnings for the state. A few days later, too late in my opinion, New York issues evacuation warnings for New York State. That was about 12 hours before landfall of the storm. Of the people in the mid-Atlantic area, including places like Delaware, that had mandatory evacuations, over 70% of the people ordered to evacuate did not evacuate. Why? Because they didn't think it was actually a threat, right? Fewer than 30% of the people ordered to evacuate in the face of the largest hurricane in recorded history chose not to leave, right? That is a major problem. It's a major communication problem for scientists. It's a major problem for emergency managers and policies. And it's a major problem for us, who apparently don't trust and believe really smart scientists when they're telling us to do something. There's a disconnect here that we've got to fix.
Okay, of the 70% who did not evacuate, how many were seriously injured?
Not the majority. I mean, certainly there were more deaths. There were far more deaths than there should have been.
But it's
got to
be a fairly small percentage.
It is.
Why is that irrational?
A question we should ask is, do you evacuate just because there's the risk of serious injury, or do you also evacuate because even if you withstand the storm and stay intact, now you're a liability to first responders, because now you're trapped in a house that's quickly becoming, you know, contaminated, and you don't have food and water, and now a first responder has to risk his or her life to come get you. Or now you're susceptible to sort of auxiliary issues like mold or electrocution or things like that. But you're right. When you look at the storm, and I can't remember the name of it, But when you look at the storm that preceded Superstorm Sandy by about 2 years, that was supposed to hit New York, and at the last minute it cut inland and it hit like Vermont, a bunch of people did evacuate in the face of that storm, and they moved inland only to be caught by the floodwaters and then have their homes looted. And they were like, look, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, no way, right? Like, I'm going to stay. So that was part of the issue for sure.
I have a question.
I just called that, but I was thinking, no matter what how horrible it is, and obviously it can be really horrible, the actual likelihood of it happening to any particular person at any particular time, like us now, is quite low.
Yeah, so the question is, so the question is, if the actual likelihood for any individual person is quite low, then why is it irrational not to, of course, I'm not answering the question. You're answering the question.
Well, you raise an important question, right? And in sort of a live free or die sort of libertarian world, it should be your decision to choose your fate. That's not what you're saying.
No, there's some probability that we'll have an earthquake 5 minutes. Very, very low, presumably, but not zero. And if it hit, it would be horrible. We all
do this last word.
But given that, even if you're living in San Francisco, or someplace where the likelihood is relatively high, it's still, given all the possibilities, pretty low. So why not just deal with it?
So people who deal with this, people who deal with risk assessment and risk management say, listen, to answer this question, what we have to do is we have to have a balance between risk and hazard, right? And so the earthquake risk for a place may be, if you take LA and New York City, it is more likely that there will be an earthquake, a significant earthquake in LA than New York City. That is true. But here are some other things that are important to consider. A 6.6 earthquake in LA and New York is going to be a stronger earthquake in New York because it's bedrock granite and it's not loose liquefied soil, because it's colder rock. For a variety of facts, that same earthquake is going to feel like a stronger earthquake in New York than it is in LA. California has far more robust building codes than New York. Different building structures. So the same exact earthquake is going to be a much bigger deal in New York than LA. So what they say is, we have to take that into account as well, and we have to factor that out. So as an individual, if you want to stay in your house because you feel like it's not an issue and you don't want to reinforce your house, okay, if you can prove to me that your house is not going to topple over on somebody walking down the street, and if you can prove to me it's not going to topple down on your neighbors, and you want to stay in your house, and you've said to the first responders, you don't have to come get me, I don't really care if you do anything about it, but... Do you wear a seatbelt? Why do you... Of course. But why do you wear a seatbelt?
Let me ask my question. The question is, there's some probability. If I walk across my very, very quiet street, there's some non-zero probability that I'll be hit by a car. Way more than if I'm just sitting in my living room. There's probably none if I just walk. But walking across the street, there's some very low probability I'll be hit by a car. Right. So why isn't it just exactly like that? The probability that we're going to have an earthquake here now is not zero, but it's very, very, very low. So to hell with it.
Do you look both ways across the street when you cross your road? Okay, why? Because the probability is low, but there may be an errant driver, right?
Question, how much should I spend my time worrying about?
And this is a great question. How much, and not just your time, but how much money should you spend, right? So if you live in, say, Tampa Bay, Florida, should you spend $20,000 to retrofit your house for an earthquake? No, you should not. That's where that hazard and risk comes into play. And I think that this is a question that households and communities have to ask. And for me, the question is, you're right. You know, if the likelihood is so low, I live in the state of Maine, so I have to make choices about my house and what I'm going to spend money in. The chance of a major earthquake in Maine is pretty damn low. So is my house earthquake proof? No. Will I make it earthquake proof? No, I will not. And that's a fair question. But we each have to take this count of hazard and risk, and I think we also have to take an account of what we can afford and also what our collective responsibility is, not to just to our house, but to the people around us, right? And I think that's an important question to ask too. But your point is very well taken.
But you would be wise to spend $20,000 on hurricane prevention in Tampa.
And in Maine, like nor'easters. I mean, just about a week ago, the majority of Maine was without power for a week, right? So I'd be very well served in investing in that possibility.
You mentioned that you were really pessimistic about predicting seismic activity, or more maybe seismologists are. Can you maybe explain why that seems like such a hopeless task? Because just from somebody who knows nothing, it seems like that shouldn't be so difficult.
This is a great question. So why can't we predict earthquakes? It's the question. And part of the problem is when you think about a hurricane, for instance, right? We see a hurricane on radar. We see a hurricane on satellites. And as soon as that happens, two things happen simultaneously. NOAA sends a super high-powered jet up into the stratosphere. And this amazing Air National Guard division that's based in Mississippi sends up these C-130 planes, and they drive right into the hurricane, right? And they drop these little devices called dropsondes that look like little toilet paper tubes into the hurricane. And they measure everything from like wind speed to wind direction to barometric pressure. And they take that and they couple that with the satellite data and the radar data and everything else like that. And they come to a relative understanding of the hurricane in that moment. And so we create these models. The U.S. used to lead the world in our models. Side story, we don't anymore, right? The European Union now has the stronger models because they've invested in it. Think about the average earthquake. We don't know where it's going to be, right? It's going to happen 5 to 30 miles underground, and nobody's going to be there to record it, right? So all we have in terms of sort of seismological research, unless you get really lucky and an earthquake happens where you happen to have installed a bunch of really expensive seismographic recording devices, is the best we can kind of do is what's called paleogeology or paleoseismology. We can kind of go back and look at previous earthquakes. And so as a result, we don't really know anything about them. We tried really hard. We invested at least tens of millions of dollars, if not more, in a project on the San Andreas Fault Zone in sort of central California. And we were like, we're pretty sure there's going to be an earthquake here. And so we installed lots and lots and lots of sensors there so that we could monitor it. So when the earthquake happened, we could understand what happened beforehand. We could understand what happened during the earthquake. And we thought if we know that, we'll be able to see it when it happens. But the earthquake didn't happen. Right? So right now, we don't know, you know, and we've never witnessed in real scientific time an earthquake that's happened. And so we know that some small earthquakes cause big earthquakes, but some small earthquakes are just small earthquakes, and we don't know the difference. We know that some earthquakes over here can cause earthquakes over here, but we haven't been able to draw that conclusion. Because if you think about it, it's happening 30 miles underground. In a place where we have no recording devices. And so these scientists, I've talked to a number of seismologists who have never been in an earthquake. Like their entire career is dedicated to earthquakes and they've never experienced one. So right now, we just don't know. And we may someday, but they say, and they're uniform in this with a few possible exceptions, but the majority of them say, listen, it's not gonna happen in our lifetime. It's not gonna happen that we're gonna be able to predict them. So let's not take our money and spend it on prediction, let's take that money and spend it on preparedness.
Question. So when you're talking about preparedness, I think the other important thing to consider, and maybe you have, I didn't read the book either, is social economic implications. So clearly the people who left New Orleans were the people who could afford it. But there is a whole group of Americans in this country who can barely eat, don't have shelter, don't have health care, they are barely getting by. So the idea of preparing for a natural disaster is something they can't even think about. And they don't have the resources to prepare for that. So that's a whole nother policy implication around how do you deal with that with people who are economically barely surviving.
It's such an important point. And when you think about Hurricane Sandy, for instance, when New York City finally issued the evacuation order, they gave able-bodied New York City residents about 12 hours to get out of New York City using mass transportation before mass transportation for able-bodied New York residents was canceled. They gave people with special needs who required assisted, you know, buses and things like that, they gave them fewer of 4 hours. That's a social justice issue, right? You know, and again, to me, my opinion is that as communities, we need to be making sure that everyone in our community is prepared for. And there is a new, really exciting program about resilient communities that's happening right now, where they're taking a look and they're saying it's not enough for our household to be prepared. It's also important that our next door neighbor, because first of all, if our next door neighbor hasn't retrofit their house and their house falls on my house, it doesn't matter. But also because it's the right thing to do, right, to take care of one another. And so from my mind, that is a smart model for all kinds of reasons. And that is exactly the way we ought to be trending. And it's a point very well taken that it is an incredible luxury to have an evacuation plan that requires an automobile and a full tank of gas and food and a place to go and the ability just to stay in a hotel, right? Exactly. That is a luxury that many people can't afford. Absolutely. And I appreciate you raising that point.
People in Ohio that have fracking, which brought in jobs, but now have earthquakes based on.
Yes, so this issue of fracking-induced earthquakes, huge issue, and I dedicate several chapters of the book to it. Ohio was where some of the first fracking-induced earthquakes happened. You take a state like Oklahoma, which for me is this incredible example of, again, sort of like environmental social justice gone wrong, right? Like we caused the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma in the 1930s, and now we're causing this other situation. So we have what scientists believe is verifiable proof that wastewater injection related with fracking causes earthquakes. Ohio has created a moratorium on wastewater injection, and so the earthquakes in Ohio has seemed to have abated. Same thing with Arkansas. Oklahoma has not, right? So Oklahoma went from one of the least seismically active states in the nation to the most seismically active state in the lower 48. Texas, also an increase in seismic activity, particularly incidentally around three major faults that run under Love Field and the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. Minor problem, right? And you're right, it's a huge issue for the people there because these are states that have made their bread and butter, you know, resource extraction, right? And for a lot of people, their jobs depend upon that. And yet, these are states where we're seeing profound seismic activity that's causing all sorts of damage. Oklahoma believes they're trying to sort of ratchet down the problem when an earthquake happens with a well. They shut down that well. A lot of activists there say it's not enough. But you're right. It's complicated. If I shut down that fracking activity and that wastewater injection activity, what am I going to do with the people there who make a living doing that, right? It's an incredibly thorny problem. I don't have an obvious solution, but I think it's a sort of holistic systemic thinking that we have to do to both preserve the landscape and the people who live there and also make sure that people are not destitute. So what else can we do if we're going to take their livelihood away from them? Well, please stick around. I'd be very happy to talk to you one-on-one. Thank you so much for coming out tonight.
That's Catherine Miles, author of Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake, speaking at the UD Journalism Program's first ever Front Page Cafe last month. We hope you enjoyed it and look forward to bringing you more from the Front Page Cafe next year. And the Green is off next week, but will return in January. We'll see you then for more on the Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.